Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is your host, Jara Pascual, founder and CEO of Collab with Anoko. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to Professor Sally Davenport. Professor Sally Davenport will be a keynote speaker at the Eastman Connect Global Conference on the 6th to 8th of December as a virtual event. Professor Sally Davenport is Director at Science for Technological Innovation and Professor at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. Her last research is about the Triple Helix Association, which is university, industry and government. Professor Sally Davenport said, "This indicates that many countries are not good at translating their high-quality research into economic and well-being impacts." In this podcast episode of Business of Collaboration, we were talking about the importance of relationship leadership as a process to support people to get the best of innovation, and how innovation systems should be flexible and enable experimentation and collaboration. Do you want to know? Listen to our podcast with Professor Sally Davenport. Welcome, Sally Davenport, to the podcast Business of Collaboration. You are a keynote speaker at the Eastman Connect Global on the 6th to 8th of December as a virtual event this time. What is your keynote about?
Well, thank you, Hara. My keynote is entitled Challenging Research from Competitions to Missions. And what I want to do is sort of, that's a slightly ambiguous title, because the challenging side of it means as in complex research, but also as in thinking about new ways that we can do research to enhance the way that the research has an impact on society.
I don't know how you see as a researcher and a professor. Like, you have some research is more applied research and the other is more theoretical research. So you are more about all research or only the applicable, the applied research?
No, I think this probably, I'm not that much of a supporter of having a delineation between those types. Oh, okay. Because often you find historically, particularly, that, you know, sometimes really, you know, theoretical research can have huge impacts. For example, as not in my area, but there's, we have a research institute in New Zealand which does a lot of data modelling and what have you, and they have been hugely influential on how our government has managed the COVID-19 response, yet they're theoretical data scientists, right? So I think that dichotomy is a bit of a misnomer. And so for us, it's more how do you think about some of the grand challenges that you have happening internationally? It's just not just New Zealand challenges, but how do you think about getting the right skill mix together to tackle something that's incredibly complex, needs lots of disciplines associated with it, yet they don't talk to each other very well, and think about the path to, I mean, I'm not after global domination here quite yet, but just think about how is the path that we can do something different so that a lot of our research has a more immediate impact on things that are really important for the globe, for the world.
And that is a very open-minded perspective. That's incredible to hear. That could be interesting how we can help researchers as well and professors to be more open-minded with their research and the impact they can have what they are doing.
Yeah, so there's two aspects of that I'd pick out. First of all, the issue with thinking about impact is that in a lot of our funding systems, it's very much what's the impact factor of the journals you're publishing in. So it's the impact on your professional community, not impact on society. And then the people who do more applied research that have more impact on society tend to get a bit sort of, you know, oh, poo-poo. They're not seen as good enough scientists. Whereas I think now we have to be a bit more open-minded about impact because, and we certainly have been thinking, this is not just my thinking, we've been most recently looking at the work of Mariana Mazzucato from the University of College London, who really much thinks about the fact that in order to, you know, do something about our sustainable development goals, for example, which are all really complex challenges, how do we harness the minds of those who are so used to, they're incredibly talented, but very used to being down in the detail, if you like, of a particular project. So when you've got traditional funding systems really have a quite a bottom-up approach. It's all about, well, that's the whole competition to missions thing, right? So how do you move from a system which is very much about principal investigators with really good track records, with lots of publications and lots of experience, bidding in to get money to do a little bit more incrementally on what they've always done, versus how do we think about harnessing a much more diverse range of competencies to think about some of these challenges, and then also how do we facilitate them working together? Oh, it's not straightforward. I'm not saying it's easy. And that's why what I will be talking about a little bit is how some of the processes we've been experimenting with to try and do this in a smaller scale, because the challenges we're talking about in New Zealand are sort of more local challenges. But, you know, how do you think about a different way of funding, which is not ultra competitive? It's still looking for quality and still has a lot of evaluation there, but it's not pitching small teams against small teams. It's about how do you form a best team to actually attack some of these missions.
And moreover, you mentioned in your documents the Triple Helix Association, that this indicate that many countries are not good at translating the high quality research into economic and well-being impacts. So that's more or less following the conversation we had now. So yeah. What are the best practices and policies and actions to better support this translation from research to well-being for the society and to have a positive impact?
Yeah, so that was a keynote speech I gave at the Triple Helix Conference in Cape Town last year. Gosh, that seems a long time ago. And really that part of it was talking about the Global Innovation Index, which I had only come across recently, which looks at lots of inputs, if you like, into research. So how good is your education? How good is your research? How good is your commercialization system? All those sorts of things, and sort of ranks. It's quite an econometric approach, but it sort of ranks the various countries. And it was interesting to see which countries. So two of the factors were, very good research systems, but not very good commercialization. So it's not translating. They're not very good at that whole chain. Well, it's not even linear, but that whole process of getting things to commercialization. And so, you know, New Zealand was one of the poorer ones in terms of the gap between that, as were a lot of the Western ones, although less so with some of the European countries. I think Denmark, for example, was almost equal. So we all aspire to be like all these other countries, but it's one of the things that made me start thinking about the fact that, well, if that's an issue for us, how do we change what we do in terms of our processes? So, I'm at a stage in my career where I can start, you know, I've been a professor in this area for about 30 years. So it's really interesting to be able to start thinking, what would we need to do to change some of these things? So the best practices, I think some of the issues I see here is so much concern about intellectual property, both inside the research community and inside any industry. So for example, we've been starting some projects that are quite early stage. And so they're not close to intellectual property, and we've got lots of industry and Māori involved as well. And you've got, and you, as soon as you start getting closer to something looking like you could actually turn it into a product, then everybody starts worrying about IP. And I think this is sort of a last century approach. I'd like to see things a lot more open, but I don't have quite the power to change that unilaterally yet. I think there's too much competitiveness. I mean, there's so much competitiveness inside New Zealand, and we're only 5 million people. So we should be thinking as a collective about thinking about the global innovation system, not about competitiveness just inside our own system. And the other thing that I think we have progressed perhaps more so than a lot of other countries is the notion of how do you include Indigenous knowledge into what you're doing and value different approaches to science and innovation and research and make that, and that's very much about relationships and things like that. So it's, you know, all of these things have been, you know, a bit close to the edge in terms of thinking, okay, oh, this is not my area, my comfort zone, but, you know, what do we do about it? And that's the fun of being able to do something like the Science Challenge.
I didn't know that it's the Global Innovation Index. It would be super cool to read more about this and how, you know, how to participate, how to help.
Yeah, off the top of my mind, I can't remember where it's all based and what have you, but the in that Triple Helix Association paper, there is a link to it. Oh, yeah. And it's got all of these different factors. And so then they do agglomerate them up. So each country has a particular index. But actually what's more interesting is look at what the component factors inside to that the things that they're looking at, because that's where you see the variation, right? And that's where you think, okay, as a country, in terms of all the other other countries, this is where we're not performing. So from that point of view, it's quite interesting. I mean, it's very much an econometric approach, but I only came across it a couple of years ago. So, but I think it has been around for quite a while. I think they put the reports out that might be annual, but it might also be every 2 years. I'm not sure. But yeah, well worth having a look at in terms of thinking about your national context, which is a bit of it's still an interesting concept about a national context versus, because so much of our value chains and the innovation system are not national, they're international. But there's still this diversity across all of these countries in terms of how they operate.
Yeah, you can be as well an index, like you can translate into your organization. You know, always in corporate you have this question, how we can measure how innovative we are.
Yeah.
So maybe it could be like, you know, looking at inside the calculation and the factor, how we can translate this to organizations somehow, you know, that could be.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know, because a lot of the things are about the education system and things like that. So it's not just about the businesses. But I certainly think that there's a real challenge, and we've actually been thinking about this quite a bit recently in New Zealand, because there's an inquiry going on at the moment about why don't we have more firms that are at the frontier? So it's always comparative, right? So we've got some very good firms in New Zealand, and some are at the international frontier, but a lot of them are just at the New Zealand frontier. So what does that mean? What's the difference? And so the thing for me is that the numbers can tell you where you are, but you really need to do a bit more qualitative research to be able to go and understand why. Okay. So, I'm a bit of a mixed methods person. I like to not only see the data, but, you know, I think, oh, yeah, that doesn't quite make sense. What's really happening there? Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with it, the reason that the IP system is so entrenched is that the incentives seem to work for everyone, right? So the research organization can make money off the IP. The organization can make money off the IP. The nation can make money off the IP through tax and what have you. And so changing that so it's open means you have to think differently about value, I think, rather than just thinking about IP generates value. Actually, sometimes you can generate a huge amount more societal value, maybe not so much commercial, but societal value, if something's open. I mean, I think that's what happened with the polio vaccine. I think, wasn't it? I think it was actually, you know, given away. So, you know, and you think about how much value that's generated around the world. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the COVID vaccine.
Situation in New Zealand regarding the industry academic collaboration for knowledge and technology transfer?
Okay, yeah, it's I think it's patchy. and part of that is this whole competition thing that we talked about before, but also I think there's quite interesting work being done, you know, over the years from an organizational point of view about different nations' approaches to wanting to control things or collaborate. And I think we're very quite strongly on the individualistic locus of control, that companies want to keep things, and universities and other people want to keep things under their control. And so there's a huge there's quite a continuum across that. And I think that's one of the issues that perhaps New Zealanders don't realise, is that actually we could, with the whole want and desire to generate, you know, great big companies based on IP, you might be better to let some control go and, you know, maybe like just license, not actually produce, because we don't have a huge manufacturing sector in New Zealand. And you might generate more value. And so from my point of view, I think there's too much competition in the system, both for companies thinking that they're competing with another New Zealand company, whereas they should be thinking about the fact they keep competing actually with an American or Finnish company. There's too much competition in the research system, and it's not very mission-led. It's not thinking, how do we solve a particular problem? It's more, where's some good ideas? And so I think you need more of a balance of that. There's competition between institutions. So in New Zealand, we have both the National Science Challenges, of which I run one, and the Centres of Research Excellence, which are pan-national research centres to get around the institutional competitiveness about who gets how much money out of the system. So the incentives on both sides have been a bit sort of, you know, not ideal. And then we also have, for us, an increasingly important aspect, or it has been for decades, but is coming to the fore very much so now, is the Indigenous Māori groups here, who, because of all our recent decades of reparations for land lost and resources lost, and now some of our biggest business owners in terms of resources and what have you. And of course, because they are so entrenched and embedded in the land and their families, their whānau, they're never going to sell. So they've been very much in the agricultural sectors and what have you. Now they're starting to move into tech. So we've also got, a huge amount of opportunity as well in these places if we can get this collaboration working better. I mean, the thing is that, you know, I'm sure just about every country in their government innovation strategy says we need more collaboration. But they don't necessarily then go and look at the whole systems to think about it. So for example, when you're building relationships, you know, if you're going to, the buzzwords around co-design and co-creating projects and what have you, and co-creating innovation, you have to build the relationship first before the project starts. And so many systems don't fund that relationship building. So it starts being a tick box exercise. So quick, I need an industry person on my application. Would you mind doing it? Whereas if you could actually, and that's one of the things that we've been experimenting with in the National Science Challenge, if you can front foot some of that collaboration relationship building before you actually decide on the project, then I think you get a much better culture, if you like, within the project about, and it should make it easier in the long run in terms of translation into implementation. Well, that's our theory anyway, so we'll let you know in a few years if it's worked yet, but it seems to be going really well at the moment.
Yeah, the other question is, how will you increase the collaboration in the triple helix equation? Because I remember going to accelerators my platform, and they were, so in the industry side, we can say, they were as well very close to say, no, we control how our startups, they talk to business. This is very limiting. So this is not thinking about even business.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have a lot of accelerators in New Zealand too, and they work really well when you've got this sort of, you know, a really interesting idea happening. So it's still quite a bottom-up approach. And our venture capital industry is certainly has ramped up in the last couple of decades. But I think, so from my point of view, I think they've sort of got to tweak the incentives in all groups, right? So the government's incentive is to make sure that everything's low risk and has been evaluated, and they don't want to invest in something that's going to end up, you know, getting on the front page of the newspaper for the wrong reasons. So you need to think about how can they take risks but still work in a policy environment. And that's one of the things I think I really like about the National Science Challenges, and to some extent also our Centres of Research Excellence, is that we're arm's length from the government. So we're funded by the government, but we're basically delegated the responsibility to think about how can we try something new. So we can experiment where perhaps government can't, right? So we're trying all sorts of things around, you know, mission labs and to decide what things we should work on, and then mission design workshops where we bring together these multidisciplinary teams. All those sorts of things. We've changed our contracts so that it allows for the collective knowledge of Te Ao Māori, the Māori world, where it's not an individual that holds the knowledge, it's actually could be a whole iwi or tribe. So we have the capacity to try new things which government can't usually do, because there's too much risk involved with allowing public funding to be spent like this. Now, we're still accountable. We're still, as I said, we're going through annual reporting at the moment, and we have a whole lovely list of key performance indicators we're supposed to hit and what have you. But it's, you know, I think doing that, allowing for that experimentation, and then, so the next thing will be how do we scale this up, which is another thing that we'll be talking with government with, okay. Then for industry, it's you know, they've been burnt so much previously with, you know, having to pay huge amounts to get access to researchers and universities and research institutes, and they're not necessarily getting what they want because the researchers don't understand the timescale, don't understand the context and things like that. So if you can get them involved in co-designing the project earlier with the researchers, then hopefully some of those things have worked out. And then the same thing for the researchers, right? Most of the incentives for them is to publish in the best journals, have as many PhD students as they can, which is a bit tricky at the moment under COVID, and, you know, not necessarily have that impactful research. But actually, a lot of the researchers that we're working with find that actually they get huge amounts more opportunity working with industry, because in solving problems, they actually also sometimes find some really good fundamental science issues to deal with as well. So it's about trying to, I mean, I'd love to click my fingers and be able to make that all happen perfectly. But I think, you know, it's more of an entrenched approaches and perspectives and sort of a lack of mutual understanding, which is why the National Science Challenge spends a lot of time on what we call capacity development. So our mission is to enhance the capacity of New Zealand to use physical sciences and economic growth. Physical sciences and engineering for economic growth. So the capacity side of it is very behavioural, right? So it's about changing behaviours, which is actually really hard to measure. But it means that we're looking at our innovation processes, not about the projects. The projects are great and they're doing fabulous stuff, but it's not about the technical capacity. It's also about the human and relational capacity, the other two aspects that we think about. So I like to think that we're taking a much more sort of social science approach to this, as much as a science approach, because we're very much looking at what are the best ways we can improve our innovation system to make it hum better for the nation.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from CollabWith. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
You have been working since many years ago on the leadership side of innovation and collaboration, and the importance of bringing people together. You call it relationship leadership above. So you mentioned exactly a process to support people to get the best of innovation and to design a process to bring people together. What is the link between relationships, diversity, and innovation?
Okay, so I think we call it relational leadership, and it's actually, it's not my term. It's related to relational capacity. We use some really great leadership trainers to help us with our community, and it's more about, you know, the fact that unlike sort of old-fashioned models of leadership, you don't actually in this era, probably in any domain, let alone just in the research domain, have control as a manager. You really don't. You can't just order people around. You really have to be much more empathetic to what the other person needs and how can you both mutually incentivize things to work for both of you. And so it's very much about the old-fashioned, you know, walking in the other person's shoes, understanding what their goals are and that sort of thing. So I think that's really important, and it's how you best manage all sorts of teams. What we find is that many of our researchers are never trained in leadership. It's assumed that you're working, when you're a junior researcher, you're working for a senior researcher who's really good leader. Well, no, that's not necessarily going to happen. So one of the things that's worked really well is that we've been doing this relational leadership training and then some coaching. And what our leadership trainers have said is that they've never come across a group of people, so this is scientific researchers, who had so little understanding about what leadership concepts. But when they're exposed to them, boy, do they pick them up quickly. They understand. All right. So I think it's a wonderful opportunity to really think about how you think about researchers, not just as fodder for the lab, these early career researchers, but also how do you build them to be really good research leadership people at the when they're older or more experienced. And one of the things that, because the traditional system, of course, is, as I said before, if you've got a really strong track record and you're probably mostly pale, male and stale, which is a phrase that's used quite a lot here in New Zealand, meaning you're an older white gentleman, then, you know, you sort of have to work your way up this way, and then you're the one that gets rewarded, and then you just have all these people doing the work for you. Whereas the way we do it with our mission design process, what we say is we decide what we're going to do. So for the moment, we're doing one around biosecurity technology, for example. So we say, right, this is what we think we're going to look at in terms of funding a project. That's the mission, biosecurity technology. We don't want you to submit a project proposal. We want you to say what capability you have to bring to a potential project. So it's called an expression of capability. And some people hate it because this is so new, but it means that anybody can come to the table, right? So we can bring those younger researchers, there's people from areas way outside of biosecurity technology, but they think they've got something to add. So anybody can come to these research workshops, and then we run a facilitated process where we focus down and decide a project. So it's quite challenging for a lot of researchers, because also industry and Māori people are also in the mission design process, so they're still there. So they still have to do something that also has the agreement of the community, not just what researchers want to do. And it's really funny because, you know, watching them, you can still see the people who are really pushing what they want to do for their project, and I'm going to get the money. Whereas actually you can see who are the more team building type people who are really interested in working in a new type of way. So, you know, this is a sort of experimentation stuff, which is really fascinating to watch from a social science point of view as well.
But it's very important, and this is reminding me on the topic of innovation procurement. So in innovation procurement, one of the issues they have is like how we can write RFIPs or RFIIs, you know, like request for proposals. Yeah. Like we can the company or the public organization that can be open enough to get startups and innovative solutions. Because if they are so strict, like you have to have the ISO 14001, you have to have 20 years of experience, you have to have, you know, then you exclude almost everyone who has an innovation. Yeah.
That's the risk aversion inside probably established companies and government, right? They want to make sure that they've ticked all those boxes, so if something goes wrong, they can say, well, it wasn't our fault. They seem to measure up, right? As opposed to experimenting, which is what you really need to do, is actually think, how can we do this a bit differently?
As well, in New Zealand, you have a program to support women via grants. How does it work? So how important is diversity and gender equality for innovation?
Well, I would say very important. This is not a government program. This is something we're experimenting with at the moment. So obviously a lot of early career researchers have been really badly impacted by the COVID issues because they're often on short-term contracts. They're just funded by a grant. They don't have permanent employment. And so we're seeing a lot of angst in that group. And of course, that group also then probably includes a lot of women, because you're talking physical sciences and engineering, where there's a huge diversity issue in there anyway. And then also Māori and Pacific researchers who have only come to STEM more lately. And so what we've decided to do, we haven't actually kicked it off yet, but we're just about to, we have two levels of grants. We have big grants, the spearhead ones, which we form through this mission design process. And then we have smaller seed ones, which we want risky science, and we'll put certain priority areas on it. And this time around, we're going to put a priority area encourage early career researchers, but particularly women, Māori and Pacific, who have been really quite disadvantaged. Well, women in general in the workforce have been disadvantaged in this whole COVID issue as well. So there's a kind of interesting new paper, it's not that new, but someone sent it to me recently, which said there's for STEM subjects, when you have an inequality gap in your nation, you tend to get more women going into STEM. Which I think, because in New Zealand, because you know we're quite high on that gender equality list, quite up there with Iceland and some of the Scandinavian countries, we've got more of a gap, which is, I think this is really odd. But anyway, we're really trying to encourage. And so what we're going to do is not just give out the grant, but also give them a small grant beforehand to help prepare the proposal. Because sometimes it's actually because they need some childcare. You know, it can be men as well, of course, if they're the primary caregiver, or you need some editing help or something like that. So sometimes it's more about making sure that that you're putting in place some support structures and things to help get them to the stage where they can produce a proposal which will make it through the assessment process, which we have to do, of course, still. But yeah, so that's something we're going to try. We already have something like there's only in New Zealand, for example, from an Indigenous point of view, there's only something like 3-4% Māori in the workforce, whereas they're more like 15-20% of the population. Our challenge, we've got 12% of our community are Māori and Pacific. So we're seeing small changes, but I think we also need to put more effort into the fact that it's not about making these diversity groups conform to us. How can we change our processes to be more supportive of them? So that's what we're trying to do.
And I think that's a personal thing. I was thinking like the next level of innovation should be, because you are working with the Māori, I am asking this question, so it should be more spiritual. So go to the next level of how we connect to ourselves and to the universe, to be able to all together, you know, to understand much more and to innovate at that level. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is a worldwide phenomenon. I'm obviously not Māori myself, but I've been on a steep learning curve in this area. But I think, but the what's happening in New Zealand, and we have a very good group of Māori researchers in our science challenge, is actually probably world leading from an Indigenous point of view, because we have the sort of the current generations are much more empowered. That we've still got huge equity issues and health issues and you know, justice issues and equity issues in the country. It's still, I know some people think that New Zealand looks like paradise. I mean, it is, but we still have to deal with some of these issues. And so but from a point of view of Indigenous involvement with science and technology and innovation, New Zealand is going to be probably one of the world leaders, along with Canada, I think, and Hawaii, potentially, from the US, depending on what happens there. You know, so there's a lot of opportunity, and some of our researchers are already publishing some really interesting material on how do we make this work in an Indigenous space. So we allocate 25% of our funding to what we call strong Matarangamari, which means Māori knowledge projects, and we have a whole what we call kahui, which is a leadership team of Māori people, both researchers and industry people, who guide us as well. So it's really about being, I think, very humble to the fact that there are other worldviews, and sometimes that can take researchers a while to really understand what that might mean.
So what is innovation for you?
That's an interesting question. For me, it's a mixture of things. So for me, I certainly, obviously, new products, new processes, new approaches to marketing, new ways of organizing. It's also at a lot of different levels. So for me, innovation is not just what happens inside firms. You can innovate in policy, you can innovate in, social. And the interesting, actually, it's one of the things I was thinking about is that one of the notions that I've struggled with a bit is that innovation is just about everybody trying new things, sometimes mostly for the positive, but not necessarily always. So we have to be careful to not have that innovation bias that everything is positive and good when you innovate. But also the fact that it's always been a social issue. So this whole notion of social innovation, I find quite a little bit disturbing, because in actual fact, there are a lot of choices that are made by people to innovate. So innovation in technology is not free from social bias, right? So who gets funded, what technology gets developed, where it's applied, who doesn't get funding, all those sorts of things are social decisions. So actually innovation is always social, if you like. So I don't really like that distinction. But for me, it's about trying new things to improve the life of humanity and the planet as well.
It's very important to talk about bias, because here I think, I don't know, in research, but in corporate environment and as well on accelerators environment, there is this kind of innovation is flying cars. You know, yeah. They have this thing of, I remember when they have no idea about innovation, or they have this strong bias, or I don't know, they are thinking like, we have to, this is only this, you know, it's high tech and science fiction.
That's technology, that's not innovation, right? The innovation has to come from the improved implementation, which means you have to think about regulatory sorts of things, about unintended consequences, all that sort of stuff. So that's the difference between technology and innovation, which often just gets conflated.
Yeah. And what is for you collaboration for innovation?
Oh, I think it's when a group of people from disparate backgrounds can get together and align their goals, not necessarily all their knowledges, right, but align their goals and work together in a way that is respectful for everybody's backgrounds, everybody's experience, what knowledge they're bringing to the table. So that's for me what the ideal innovation collaboration would look like.
And what is the thing you are most proud of?
In terms of inside the National Science Challenge, I think the thing is that we've really taken on board the fact that we've been delegated the responsibility to experiment and try new things and be prepared to fail, which I think, you know, it's often hard in an innovation system to do that. It's hard enough inside a company where they have most of the control, whereas in a system where we're trying new things, of course it does help if you've got funding, so that you can always dangle this incentive to get people to cooperate with you and try new things. But that's for me, I think, you know, we really are putting a lot of theory into practice and learning as we go. So because we have inside the challenge, we not only have technical scientific teams, we also have a social science team called Building New Zealand's Innovation Capacity, and they're studying what we're doing. So we're also learning. It's very much about how can we do this better in New Zealand, but I'm sure a lot of it will be relevant for other countries as well.
Everyone.
Yeah.
I think that's how we can do better. We can apply even at home. So yeah. How the is the failure you were learning the most?
Yeah, so it's one of the key messages I try and get across to everybody in our mm-hmm. community, which is about, you know, 450 researchers. I don't see failure as failure. I see failure as a chance to learn and improve. Mm-hmm. And which is really hard normally to do, but this is what we have been trying to do. So for example, one of the times we tried to form a team, it didn't quite gel. You know, we never quite got a proposal out of them, even though we did our process and we thought, well, this is interesting. It's always worked before. Why hasn't it worked this time? Mm-hmm. So we're trying again on a slightly different tack, but using a process called concept knowledge theory, which Olga Kaczynski from RMIT, who's also a very good ISPM participant, is helping us with. So we're doing an online sort of facilitation process, and it seems to be working really well. I mean, we're only two-thirds the way through it, but this time this community seems to be gelling a bit better, and I think we've put a slightly more structured process in place. So it's more about, okay, that didn't work. What can we try? If this one doesn't work, well, then we'll just blame those scientists. It must be them, not our process. But yeah, you know, you have to think about it. And we've been also encouraging that with a lot of our projects. So we've said to them, you know, if things aren't working, but you can see a slightly different tangent you could go on, come and talk to us and we'll allow you to pivot, right? So it's about making failure, or at least not success, something that you can still work on. It's not, because, you know, most people, if they've got a grant and it doesn't work, they're not going to say anything because they'll risk losing the money. Well, we're not saying that. We're saying, look, we wanted you to do risky research. Failure is inevitable. We allow you to change direction. It won't be a completely new project, but we'll allow you to change direction if you can see an option for doing something slightly different. So this is another thing that we've built into our contracts, which we call the pivot, which is unfortunately a bit overused now in the COVID times where most businesses are having to pivot, but this is what we used it for in terms of thinking, actually, I have hit a roadblock there. I just need, maybe this one might work better. So that's sort of it's more of a, if you like, it's a slightly more, not a causation sort of approach, but a sort of an effectuation approach for those people who are in the innovation space will understand that it's about thinking about different options of ways I can go rather than just thinking I've got one goal and if I don't make it, I'm a failure.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because all about relation of money, you know, with the grants for research, and yeah. You are saying, I want to go this with the result. You cannot predict the result beforehand. Yeah. So there is no fail. I mean, in research, how you failure is not trying, you know, not experimenting.
Yeah, somehow. Yeah. Exactly. So you want to, you know, most of the incentives in the system are for people to almost make sure they've got results before they get the grant, you know, because it's sort of that way you can definitely be successful. Whereas that's not what research is about. You know, I remember I had some students who had in my master's degree who did a t-shirt for their class and it said, if we knew what we're doing, it wouldn't be called research. So,
so now we have more personal questions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what is your favorite place for holidays?
Has to be a beach. I don't mind where. Just a beach. I'm a real beachy person. Long walks on the beach, swims. I've had my first swim we're coming into summer here. I had my first swim this weekend. Not too hot, not too cold, just right, you know. So I don't mind where it is.
22 degrees.
Yeah. So it's a real Goldilocks approach to a holiday. But yeah, so I think by water, but preferably a beach. Yeah, it's my favorite.
Do you have a routine in the morning, or how do your mornings look like?
I've never really been a very morning person. I had to be when I had the kids, but I'm more of an evening person actually. So my mornings are very much try and get myself out of bed on time, and get to work or get to the gym. Because I really love cooking, so I'm much more of a home-based sort of, you know, have a lovely dinner type person, actually.
Mm-hmm. So, but you are getting a cup of tea or coffee?
Oh, you mean for breakfast? No, actually, I don't drink tea or coffee first thing in the morning. I have kombucha and an egg or some avocado on toast, something like that.
What are you doing with your spare time on weekends?
Interesting. Luckily, because of the way we've locked down here in New Zealand, our weekends and evenings are pretty much like they were before COVID. So I'm now empty nesting. My two kids are not at home anymore. So we love going to festivals and concerts and foodie events. I like gardening. I've just got an e-bike, so I'm getting a bit more mobile again on that. We go to our little beach house, which we did this last weekend. It's quite social. We're away this last weekend. It was a long weekend here in New Zealand, and so we were with eight people up at our little beach house and doing all sorts of fun things. So,
and the last question: what is your favorite music?
Okay, I saw that one and I thought, gosh, that's difficult because
we can switch to books. What is your favorite book?
I have a real varied taste in music. I'm a bit of an old rocker from way back. So there's a little bit of you know, people like, you know, I know Rolling Stones or what have you in there, probably the best concert I've ever been to, Dire Straits, those sorts of things. I love people like Coldplay. Also some more of the more instrumental stuff that's coming out now. My kids keep sending me things that they'll think that I'll like. So it's more, eclectic, I would say, is my taste. But something to dance to is always favourite.
Thank you very much, Sally Davenport. It was a lovely conversation.
Well, thank you, Hara.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabwave.org. See you next week.